The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Jean Bajelan is an historian of the Middle East. He also serves on the editorial board of the journal Kurdish Studies, and publications including Turkey Scope, Jacobin, and Open Democracy have featured his commentary on present-day Middle Eastern affairs. He is a guest this week as we revisit the questions around the Syrian Civil War, U.S. involvement in the region, and how the Anglophone left should understand and possibly even intervene in the conflict. It's Wednesday, May 9th, 2018, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. I want to point out that the latest Zero Books YouTube video is online. This week's video pulls a quote from the Zero Books title, Dead Man Working, in order to better understand what the dominance of Facebook means for humanity. I also want to thank Harry A., Guy M., Albin M., Dracuma, and a person calling themselves Suck My Dick Ederson for supporting us on Patreon. If you aren't supporting this podcast through the Inside Zero Books Patreon page, you're missing out on a second podcast every week. I'd urge you to go ahead and take the plunge. For $5 a month, you'll receive a second Zero Books podcast every weekend. The music you're listening to right now is the instrumental bit from Childish Gambino's This Is America. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Jean Bajelan and I discuss Syria and the Kurds. Jean Bajelan is an assistant professor in the Department of History at Missouri State University. His research focuses on Middle Eastern affairs, and he has previously taught and studied in the United States, in the United Kingdom, Turkey and Iraqi Kurdistan. Jean, thank you very much for coming on to the Zero Books podcast.
Thank you so much for inviting me on, Douglas.
Yeah, maybe we can start by filling out your bio a little bit. Who are you?
Well, as you mentioned in the lead-in, I'm an assistant professor of history at Missouri State University, located in the beautiful city of Springfield in southwestern Missouri. Although I am originally, as you might guess from my accent, from the United Kingdom, as you might guess from my peculiar name, I'm not of pure Anglo-Saxon heritage. My father is an Iraqi Kurd. My mother is from Wales. And I've been, you know, fascinated in the history, politics, and development of the Middle East, you know, for as long as I can remember. And, of course, studied that at university. I did my undergraduate in the University of London, the School of Oriental and African Studies. I went on, studied a master's degree in the London School of Economics. And after that, I moved to Turkey, where I spent 4 years, studied history in a Turkish university, after which I went back to Britain and got my DPhil, and then took a job in Iraq while I was finishing my DPhil, and then sort of got this job in Missouri and came out here. As you might be well aware, the job market for academics is not amazing these days. So I was very happy to have this job here in Springfield.
Well, I'm glad to have you on after my interview with Oz Chatterjee. He was on the Inside Zero Books podcast, and I released it also on YouTube. And I received a lot of criticism for giving a platform to him because he was for regime change. And I wanted to have someone on who had a different perspective. You've been writing quite a lot about Kurdish struggle in the region.
As someone of Kurdish origin, I follow the fate of the Kurdish community especially closely. And of course, in recent years in Syria, you know, the Kurdish community has come to the fore. And, you know, they're a group in the Syrian civil war, which until recently have been very much sidelined. Now, I have to confess my biases when I'm coming to this. I do come to this question of the Syrian civil war from a Kurdish perspective, as you know, or you might regard me as coming at this question from a Kurdish perspective, although I do hope I can sound a little bit more impartial on this issue. Now, when it comes to intervention, the word intervention can mean many, many different things. So, you know, are we talking about diplomatic intervention, humanitarian aid, or military intervention? So there are, of course, different types of intervention. And I do, for example, believe that in terms of providing humanitarian aid, you know, the US, the UK, and Western powers should be doing a lot more than they are doing currently. However, of course, your question is sort of pushing on this issue of military intervention, whether the West should militarily intervene in the Syrian civil war. Well, I think, you know, we have to sort of come from the point where we are at this very moment, which the US, Great Britain, and France have intervened in the Syrian civil war. So do we believe that they should, the question really should be, should this intervention continue? And my answer would have to be a very qualified yes. In particular, from the Kurdish perspective, at present, there is an important left-wing political experiment taking place in Rojava, the predominantly Kurdish but not exclusively Kurdish regions of northern Syria. Compared to the other sides in the Syrian civil war, the activities of the political organizations in Rojava, the PYD, the dominant political party there, have been a lot more defensible. They've been a lot less brutal. This is not to say that they've been perfect. This is not to say there aren't issues with what's going on in Rojava. But I think this is a political experiment that is worthy of protection. And from a pragmatic perspective, there is simply no other military force that that the Kurds of Syria can rely on at present to protect their experiment. They're under threat from groups such as ISIS, from the Syrian government to a certain extent, and of course, above all, from the Republic of Turkey. And this is evidence, you know, the importance of U.S. protection to the Rojava experiments was really demonstrated in the recent assault on Afrin. Afrin was a Kurdish-dominated city in the north of Syria, which was recently invaded and occupied by Turkish forces. And the reason that Turkish forces were able to do that was because Afrin, which, if you know the geography of northern Syria, is actually detached from the main region of Kurdish settlement and the main region of PYD control. It's sort of located to the west on the Turkish frontier. And that region of Kurdish control was actually protected by the Russians. And when the Russians withdrew their support, this immediately offered an opportunity for the Turks to move on in and basically destroy the experiment of Kurdish self-rule in that region and engage in all kinds of brutalities, including looting and, rape, abduction, and those kind of things. So, you know, I support a continuation of the mission to protect the Kurds, although I do not support any further sort of attempts to sort of engage in military action against the Assad regime. And this leads to my second point. You know, you mentioned regime change. Well, yes, if we're talking about a popular revolution to overthrow Assad, I would like to see that really regime change. But when it comes down to a Western-led regime change, something akin to what happened in Afghanistan, something akin to what happened in Iraq, I would not like to see that. And more generally, you know, if we, we have to look at this pragmatically. You know, ultimately, there's going to have to be a diplomatic solution in Syria, and that diplomatic solution, whether we like it or not, is going to have to involve either Assad or elements of the Assad regime. And I refer here to a point made by Thabo Mbeki, the former president of South Africa, in 2003, saying that, look, you know, the main idea of his point that he makes is that, you know, the apartheid regime was a brutal regime by any stretch of the imagination. But an international criminal court coming in and arresting F.W. de Klerk in 1994 wouldn't have solved the situation. You know, in order to, you know, we need to end the civil war. That's the priority. And in order to do that, you're going to have to be dealing with some very unsavory characters. It's not moral, it's not just, but the suffering is intense. So when you talk about regime change, I say definitely that's something which I don't think the United States or the Western powers should do, nor do I think necessarily that they have the ability to do it in the sense of being able to remove Assad and providing a stable replacement for him.
How is it that the Kurdish struggle has taken on this socialist and progressive character? How is it that of all the different struggling factions in Syria and Turkey and in the Middle East that the Kurds have championed the most progressive agenda?
That's actually a really good question, and it's a complicated question. Well, firstly, you know, when we look at the development of Kurdish nationalism, it's a kind of interesting case study for the development of nationalism, because normally when we look at the development of a particular separatist movement, it's in relation with one particular power. So, for example, Irish nationalism sort of develops in antagonism with English or British nationalism, right? Mm-hmm. And Ireland is ruled by Great Britain. But the Kurds are divided between several different countries. And in each of those different countries, the political dynamics in those countries, in Iraq, Iran, Syria, has shaped the Kurdish movement. Now, the Kurdish movement in Syria, which is to a certain degree an offshoot of the Kurdish movement in Turkey, has a left-wing sort of orientation due to the nature of the Turkish Republic and its relationship with the Kurdish community. In the 1950s, when multi-party elections are introduced into Turkey, the Turkish Republic is actually extremely successful in integrating tribal leaders and feudal aristocrats into the sort of body politic of the Turkish Republic. Turkish political parties, for example, they create a kind of Tammany Hall of the Mountains where tribal leaders provide blocks of voters for different political parties. So this means sort of the traditional aristocratic and tribal elite of Kurdish society came to be very much associated with Turkish oppression. As a result, the Kurdish nationalism that developed in Turkey took on this sort of left-wing characteristic. And we might characterize this with the Kurdish movement in Iraq, which is far more right-wing and neoliberal in its orientation, because due to the sort of extensive racial bias of the Iraqi state, you have not only lower class individuals being alienated from the Iraqi state, but also the traditional tribal elites. So the Kurdish movement that emerges in Iraq is often led by more conservative tribal leaders, as opposed to the situation in Turkey, where you have a kind of a more radical movement. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. My question also is, like, how does someone like Murray Bookchin, and this is really kind of the U.S.-centric leftist question, but how did someone like Murray Bookchin come to be a figure of importance for the struggle of the PKK or the PYD?
That's actually also another excellent question. And I guess the answer lies in the kind of authoritarian history of the PKK. I mean, the PKK was traditionally, despite the rhetoric it's putting forward today about democratic confederalism and, you know, local self-government, the PKK was an extremely centralized and authoritarian organization. Now, on some level, you know, when you're fighting a war against NATO's second largest army, you know, you have to have a centralized organization. We can all be, you know, radical anarchists, but, you know, like when you fight a war, there's certain realities that need to be taken into account. But the PKK's authoritarianism was more than just a kind of a product of the war. It was also reflected by, you know, Öcalan's sort of attempt to build him, you know, Öcalan's sort of attempt to build a cult around himself, to his refusal to share power, and so on and so forth. So by the time Öcalan is captured by the Turkish authorities in 1999, he has this enormous influence over Kurdish society, an unprecedented influence over the Kurdish movement. So even though he's been removed from the day-to-day management of the PKK and its affiliates, his personal predilections have an enormous influence. And while in jail, somehow he got a copy of Murray Bookchin's work and ran with it. And because he became interested in it, so the movement became interested in it. So it's related to this sort of cult of personality which developed around the PKK's leader, Abdullah Öcalan. And I would note, this cult of personality was something acquiesced to by many Kurdish intellectuals of the time. I remember one financial backer of the Kurdish movement in Turkey, someone who lived in Great Britain, when I asked him about, the cult around Öcalan, this was just after his capture, I said, this cult's a little bit creepy, it's a little bit weird, why obsessed by one man? And they made the point, it's like, in Turkey, the Kurds were so oppressed that we needed a figure that could counter Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. Mustafa Kemal Atatürk was this huge figure in Turkish culture and society. His picture was everywhere. He's the founder of the Turkish Republic. And the argument was, in order to give ourselves some self-respect, we had to build ourselves up a leader to the same degree as the cult of Atatürk in Turkey. So, Öcalan's cult is a byproduct of the Atatürk cult that exists in Turkey. As too, I would note, is the Erdogan cult. The Erdogan cult is a product of the Atatürk cult in Turkey as well. So the original sin, if you would say, is one of Turkish nationalism.
It's really interesting to me that it takes a cult of personality for one of these left theorists to take hold. Murray Bookchin, of course, opposed Stalinism and cults of personality and authoritarian hierarchies his entire life, but it takes something like a Stalin figure to impose his ideas on a people.
Yeah, it's definitely one of the more peculiar ironies of the emergence of democratic confederalism as an idea which is sort of not only discussed in the salons of Brooklyn, but is actually, being, experimented with as a governing ideology on the ground.
I saw the end of the classical workers' movement. And I had to ask myself, why had this come about? What did this mean? And the conclusion I came to is this, that the workers' movement never really had a revolutionary potential. That this workers' movement had never really had the revolutionary potentialities that Marx attributed to it. That in point of fact, the factory, which is supposed to organize the workers, in Marx's language, mobilize them and instill in them the class consciousness that is to stem out of a conflict between wage labor and capital, in fact, had created habits of mind in the worker that served to regiment the worker, that served, in fact, to assimilate the worker to the work ethic, to the industrial routine, to hierarchical forms of organization, and that no matter how compellingly Marx had argued that such a movement could have revolutionary consequences, in fact, such a movement could have nothing but a purely adaptive function, an adjunct to the capitalist system itself.
We've been talking about the PKK and the PYD already, but we haven't said who they are. So what are or who are the PYD and the PKK, and what has the PKK been doing, or has it been doing anything in Syria? Are there two organizations? How should we think about the PKK and the PYD?
This is actually a very simple point. The PKK and the PYD are connected. There's no doubt that, there is an overlap, ideologically speaking, between the two organizations, and also in terms of personnel and manpower, although in other ways they are separate organizations. So I think the best, sometimes the PYD is described as a PKK affiliate. I prefer the term sister party in that, you know, the PYD and PKK may have a common origin, but they have, you know, a separate institutional existence, separate interests, and so on and so forth. So I use the term sister party. Now, the first one, the PKK was a political party established in the late 1970s in Turkey at a time of sort of great tumult amongst the Kurdish population. You know, we're seeing the emergence of sort of a new wave of Kurdish mobilizations. You know, in 1969, you have sort of Kurdish organizations springing up across the country. And over the course of the 70s, you have a continued mobilization. And the PKK is one of several groups that emerges during this period of sort of Marxist revolutionary movement. However, what marks the PKK out from other organizations, A, is that it attacks other Kurdish political organizations. So, for example, the PKK advocates the creation of a unified, independent, socialist Kurdistan made out of all the parts of Kurdistan, Turkish Kurdistan, Syrian Kurdistan, Iraqi Kurdistan, Iranian Kurdistan, and any other Kurdish political organization that had that was sort of advocating anything less than that, autonomy, self-rule, such as the Kurdistan Socialist Party, that was a contemporary of the early PKK, was an enemy, was seen as a collaborationist, and was attacked. The PKK also attacked feudal aristocrats. So they were very aggressive in trying to build a base of support in Kurdistan. In 1980, there's a military coup in Turkey. Most of the other Kurdish organizations are crushed. Hundreds of Kurds are arrested, and they're put in prison in Diyarbakir. And Diyarbakir prison in the early 1980s is this really brutal place where, you know, hundreds of men and women are sort of subjected to the most disgusting tortures by the Turkish intelligence services. Meanwhile, the PKK flees to Syria, and sort of when military rule ends, it's the only big Kurdish guerrilla movement left standing. And from 1984 onwards, they start building this huge base of support in Kurdistan and launch this guerrilla warfare, which continues, to this day. However, you know, in the 1990s, they begin to soften their line on Kurdish nationalism, calling for self-rule. And eventually, after Öcalan's capture, we see the emergence of this new ideology, democratic confederalism. Now, the PKK is a large political organization, sort of has affiliates in other parts of Kurdistan. The PKK operates primarily in Turkey, but it has affiliates in Iran, such as the Kurdish Free Life Party, known as PEJAK, and the PYD in Syria. And it's kind of interesting because, you know, throughout its existence, Syria offered support and sanctuary to the PKK and allowed the PKK to sort of organize in parts of Syria. And the reason Syria did this was, A, it was a good way to distract its own Kurdish population, you know, by directing them towards Turkey. And of course, Syrian-Turkish relations have always been strained. For example, the province of Hatay in southern Turkey had been part of Syria up until I think 1939, I want to say, when it was handed to Turkey. So, you know, Syria has territorial disputes with Turkey. And also there are issues over Turkish constructions of dams, which restrict the water supply to Syria. So Kurdish nationalism was this opportunity that the sort of Syrians kind of used and allowed the PYD and PKK to operate. However, sort of since the Syrian war, the PYD in Syria has sort of taken on a life of its own and has become effectively the ruling party across much of northern Syria. So although it continues to have close relations with the PKK, it also has its own sort of specific interests. So for example, when when there was major fighting in 2015 and 2016 between the Turkish government and the PKK in Turkey, the PYD did not intervene militarily into Turkish affairs. They've tried to maintain relatively good relations with Turkey.
Well, let's take a step back and look at the Syrian civil war, starting with the Arab Spring. Because one of the things the way I think about the Arab Spring is that it was a truly ground up, you know, grassroots mass movement for regime change throughout the Middle East, but that it didn't have any organized basis. It didn't have any real coherent parties or political vision. It was just a spontaneous uprising. And then the fallout from that has been that you have a lot of failure. To what extent do you think the circumstances we're looking at with the Syrian civil war are the result of there not being enough organization for the people to express themselves and to implement a new order? And how is the PYD a remedy for that problem?
I would generally agree with that point. Sort of the Arab Spring was this organic uprising. You know, you have let me give you an example. For most of my sort of time studying at university, the classic essay question you would get at the end of a Middle East politics or a Middle East history class would be, why have authoritarian Arab regimes been so resilient historically? Now, of course, after 2010, that question becomes a little bit redundant and kind of in retrospect looks like a rather silly question. But so, yes, these uprisings were a reaction against sort of years of authoritarian rule. You had sort of, problems brought about by the process of neoliberal reform, which had sort of swept across the Middle East, even in so-called revolutionary regimes like Syria or Egypt. You have this sort of discontent growing. But as you point out, as you indicate, there aren't many organized political groups that can take advantage of this discontent. So, for example, in Egypt, it's the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the political party with the most organizational strength, that ultimately sort of came out on top in the first round of the Arab Spring. There was no real left organization to challenge it. You know, the Muslim Brotherhood were the only ones with the organizational ability to actually seize power. And the Syrian civil war is actually another good example of this. The reason that the PYD was able to seize control of parts of northern Syria was because the Syrian regime had allowed a certain degree of Kurdish political activity to take place take place in the Kurdish regions of the country. You know, from the Syrian regime's perspective, this was a useful way to keep, you know, the Kurds busy, direct them towards Turkey. But sort of more generally, for the Syrian government, the Kurds were seen as kind of outsiders to the Syrian community. Therefore, you know, were they to be allowed to have allowed to have their organizations, they're not going to constitute a fundamental threat to the Assad regime's hold on power. Whereas if you allowed some kind of autonomous political organization amongst the Sunni Arab community, that might have been more of a threat. So the Kurds at the beginning of the Syrian civil war were actually at an advantage over other groups in the country precisely because they had that organizational base. So the kind of point that you're getting to, I think, is a good one. It is that, you know, like when we look at this rebellion, you know, we can see it as an organic rebellion, but, you know, its outcomes were determined by a very real balance of political forces that exist.
Right. And so my question is whether or not the Kurdish struggle can be universalized in Syria. Whether or not getting behind that struggle will lead to any predictable outcome for the rest of Syria.
That is, well, this is something that the PYD itself has proclaimed. You know, the PYD eschews traditional Kurdish nationalism, i.e. the sort of nation-state nationalism. For example, the nationalism espoused by the Iraqi Kurds. The Iraqi Kurdish political leadership wants a Kurdish state, you know, traditional, what we might call in England, your meat and two veg nation-state for the Kurds. Whereas the PYD rejects the nation state as a model for solving the Kurdish question and argues that its political model that it's espousing, i.e. sort of a form of decentralized communal government, would be a model applicable to the entire of Syria. Now, so sort of in an abstract sense, I think that, you know, the political model offered by the PYD could definitely be universalized. However, what one has to understand in the Middle Eastern context is the deep racism or, you know, prejudice towards the Kurds in the region and sort of anything produced by Kurdish groups. So, you know, were I to make a comparison with the United States, imagine we saw amongst African Americans a large socialist movement growing up. We would all definitely be in favor of it becoming a sort of universal movement for the entire country. But we'd also be aware that because of its association with a particular community, that that political project would be susceptible to attacks on racial grounds, if you see what I mean.
Yeah. It just wouldn't be easy even for the black socialists to figure out a way to become universalized. I mean, and it's not just because of the racist attacks from the outside, although that would exist. The problem is, how do you hold on to your black identity or Kurdish identity?
While at the same time this is actually a perennial problem of Kurdish activists in the left in the Middle East. You know, in the Middle East, you know, the PKK, as well as other Kurdish socialist groups. For example, during the 1970s, there was a very important socialist movement in Iranian Kurdistan called Komala, which in many ways was a kind of a forerunner to the PKK, in that it had female guerrillas, it was advocating women's rights, and so on and so forth. And the perennial and the reason you see the emergence of these peculiarly Kurdish left-wing political parties is partly a response to the failure of the more general Middle Eastern left to deal with the Kurdish question. The inherent chauvinism of the Turkish left, the Iranian left, and the Arab left. These have been, you know, the ethnic tensions have been existent in socialist movements across the Middle East, and you know, the Kurdish left as a distinct institutional entity is a product of that complete failure.
So the problem maybe also in Syria is just that there is no Syrian left for the Kurds to align with in a way to take power.
Exactly. I mean, the ongoing suppression of the left means that, you know, it's hard to build partners. You know, the PYD should not be imposing, things on the non-Kurdish population. They should be interacting with representatives of the of non-Kurdish groups, if you see my point there. But you need to have a partner, you know. And that's traditionally been the problem that the Kurdish left has had, you know, a lack of partners on the other side.
I mean, we're not even really getting to the level of violence and chaos and oppression and that's going on in the bombing. I mean, to try to overcome difficulties that are really stymieing the left in the United States, you know, in a moment of peace and prosperity in global terms, you know, if you look at it in context, to try to demand that the Kurds overcome these problems in war conditions, I mean, it's a huge task. So let's talk about Assad a little bit, because there's a certain segment of the left, I don't know how big it is, but it's vocal online, that looks to Assad as being an ally for the left because of his anti-Western imperialist position. I'm not even sure if it's a stance exactly, but he's seen as being the last stalwart against U.S. imperialism in the region. What would you say to leftists who see Assad as an anti-imperialist force?
Well, I think those people are either they have a specific agenda, or for the most part, I think they're just they've just failed to understand what's happening, or at least I don't agree with their assessment of what's happening in Syria at the moment. There's an old saying, for example, that I believe the quote is that It has been said critically that there is a tendency in many armies to spend the peacetime studying how to fight the last war. And that that statement kind of fits the sort of anti-war movement in the United States in a general sense with regards to its attitudes in Syria. So the anti-war movement really, grew precipitously after the Iraq war. And Iraq was a relatively simple narrative. We could all agree Saddam Hussein was a pretty terrible guy. In fact, we in the West had been the people arming Saddam Hussein during the 1980s. However, it was a clear case of America choosing to go into Iraq, fight this preemptive war, which was kind of seen by many people, and also lying us into war. So, we had this kind of relatively easy to understand narrative, right? We could, me as someone of Kurdish origin could be quite happy to oppose the invasion of Iraq because, I could, say I'm not supporting Saddam Hussein. I'm supporting this unprovoked U.S. attack, which is, dangerous for a whole host of reasons.
You're opposing that attack.
Yeah, that I'm opposing it, that it was easy to say because you say I'm not defending Saddam Hussein. I'm opposing an attack. I'm opposing the United States choosing this war. The Iraq problem was something chosen by the United States. The Syrian civil war was not provoked or chosen by the United States. Despite what some of the conspiracy theorists, both on the right and the left, this was not a CIA-inspired plot or conspiracy. This was an uprising caused by a whole host of complicated factors, including years of oppression, neoliberal reforms, and climate change. Climate change played a pivotal role in this. And I have seen firsthand, living in northern Iraq, in Iraqi Kurdistan, I've seen firsthand, what is happening there with climate change. I remember the first time I went to Iraq in 2004, and the changes that have taken place since that time in terms of the environment. You have these dust storms, you have desertification, you have I remember, for example, Arab nomads coming into Kurdistan, and it was a big deal. I think this was in 2007 because this tribe hadn't traditionally crossed into Kurdistan, but they begged to come in and being given permission to graze the animals there because their traditional pastures had been destroyed by climate change. So we have this huge, complicated issue that was not caused by the United States, but was, or at least not caused directly by the United States. And in terms of the conflict that's taking place in there, it's actually an arena for inter-imperialist rivalries. I mean, Russia is not an anti-imperialist state. It's just a weaker imperial power, second-rate imperial power. It's backing the Assad regime. And then you have the Turkey, the United States, the Gulf states, Saudi, involved in anti-Assad forces. So we have this complicated sort of clash of inter-imperialist rivalries. And, that's something that people on the left have to come to terms with. There are no Assad is, if Assad is anti-imperialist, what is he defending? What is the political project that Assad is defending? And secondly, how do we conceptualize Russian involvement in Syria? Is Russia not an imperialist power? That's another point. That's not to say that, we can't conceptualize U.S. or British or French intervention as imperialist. But let's be realistic about this. This is an inter-imperialist conflict, and every side in this civil war has its own external imperialist barricade. And that doesn't mean that any of the sides in the civil war, whether it's Assad or the Islamists or the Kurdish groups, are puppets of anyone. They are also working for their own interests and, of course, engage in relations with external forces because that's just simply a military and political necessity. So that's something else people really have to understand.
Yeah, and a lot of people in that sort of pro Assad camp would call the PYD puppets of the United States, which is just, I'm picking up on the fact you're saying these people, all these different factions have their own interests, and we really should hold on to the idea that the PYD has its own interest and its own political project. And frankly, As someone who's on the left and part of what I consider to be the Marxist left in the United States, the PYD is the only group in the region that has anything close to political ideology or vision that I could get behind. And even though I don't consider Murray Bookchin to be, you know, the best political theorist necessarily. I mean, I don't hate him at all, but I have disagreements. But and I don't know enough about this confederated democratic system that they advocate. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, democratic confederalism can be kind of summed up as a kind of radical form of local self-government, where you have kind of communes which manage affairs at a very local level. You know, it makes, like in the Middle East context, traditionally you've had very centralized governments where, you know, even the smallest piece of administration has to go through the capital, in order for something to get done. The PYD, democratic confederalism, or at least how it's interpreted, is that, you know, you try and sort of have decision making at the lowest possible level, right? And then you have a bottom-up system of government rather than a top-down system of government. That particularly makes sense within the Middle Eastern context. For much of the 20th century, the sort of main paradigm of state building in the Middle East has been this highly sort of centralized form of modernization. And basically, the idea is, the underlying idea of sort of nation-state development in the 20th century in the Middle East has been the more centralized, the better. If we're going to defend our state against imperialism, for example, we need to have a strong central government. This kind of reverses this and talks about having, well, not only radical self-government, but also gender equality, ecology, setting up cooperatives, a couple of weeks ago, for example, I was in Yale, and, you know, there were a series of very interesting talks about some of the sort of cooperatives that were being established in Syria, in Rojava, in order to, you know, make weapons, make sort of clothes, and so on and so forth. But it's also a little bit of a vague idea, which different groups are kind of interpret in different ways. That's why I use the term experiment quite a lot, because, you know, Öcalan is this traditionally... the irony is, you know, Öcalan, as I mentioned earlier, is this big centralizing figure in the Kurdish movement. But, you know, since he's kind of in prison and doesn't have kind of direct day-to-day control of the Kurdish party, there's actually a lot of room for experimentation with these ideas as well. So, you know, they're being interpreted in different ways in different places.
What I'm feeling right now is this sort of dread, because while I like the... From what I support the Kurds, and I like this idea. I love the idea of a political experiment taking hold and people working together locally and nationally to develop a new political order. I just feel like the conditions there are so horrible that to run to try to experiment with new political forms under those conditions is just fraught with peril, and also that. There just seem to be, as we discussed, these roadblocks to any true Kurdish victory for all of Syria, for the whole region. So, what do you feel would be the best outcome? And when you look ahead into the future, I mean, I know it's almost impossible to really predict anything. I'm not asking you to predict, but just like, what would you wish for if you could wish for a good outcome?
I would like to see, at least most immediately, an end to the violence, right? You know, people get hung up on the poison gas issue quite a lot. Both the kind of tanky left, which refuses to admit that Assad could have done such a thing, or, you know, come up with conspiracy theories, but also sort of your standard muscular liberals in America who want to sort of lay down the law on poison gas. My point would be is that, you know, forget, even if, let's just say all this poison gas stuff is fake, just consider the enormous amount of death and destruction that is taking place from conventional weapons. I mean, if you ask me, if I had a choice between getting poison gassed or getting burnt to death or getting, you know, digging my own grave and then getting shot in the back of the head, I might go for the gas, you know? So, you know, like the brutality of the Civil War needs to come in. So
I'd have to study up. I don't know which would be the most painful way to go.
I mean, I think psychologically speaking, digging your own grave and then getting shot in the back of the head is probably the most stressful.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
So, I mean, like my point would be, I would like to see an immediate stop to the violence, and I would like to see an immediate sort of negotiated solution, which includes Kurdish groups, that includes the Syrian government, that includes those Islamist groups that can be dealt with. I mean, you know, I think the priority has to be to stop that brutality. I mean, in a kind of more ideal world, I would like to see the kind of political experiments taking place across Syria to be taking place across the entire Middle East. Frankly, the political orders that have been established in the post-Ottoman era have been pretty disastrous for many sections of the of the Middle Eastern population. You know, this idea of having a highly centralized government, of the idea of having one nation, one flag, one people. You know, these kind of models have proved to be unfortunate in Middle Eastern history. So, yeah, you know, in an ideal world, I would like to see, you know, not only experiments with democratic confederalism, but proper social democracy. I mean, and things like this. I mean, I wouldn't describe myself as a communist. I mean, I tend to identify myself most closely with an Iron Bevan, the great British statesman and the father of the National Health Service. But, you know, I want to see sort of a lot of different flavors on the left being tried out in the Middle East. A lot of different, you know, experimentations and orders being worked on. So that would be the ideal solution. And basically have a situation where, you know, we can, you know, where Kurds and other groups in the Middle East can at least work harmoniously with one another.
How would that come to be? I mean, what power players would have to come together to negotiate a peaceful resolution to the Syrian civil war? What would be done with Assad, and what would we do with the remnants of ISIS and other Islamic terrorists in the region?
I mean, groups like ISIS, first of all, I mean I would argue a group like ISIS specifically needs to be treated like a law and order problem rather than a political problem per se. I mean, that specific group. However, of course, you know, the sea within which they swim is a political problem. But that particular group, in terms of, you know, the way that it's acted and how it operates. But there are other Islamist groups that I find extremely distasteful, which would, you know, sort of groups associated with the Free Syrian Army that would have to be taken into account. I mean, you don't make peace with your friends, you make peace with your enemies. In terms of what forces would have to be involved, I mean, you have to have the Syrian government, you have to have the FSA, you have to have the Kurds, Russia involved, you have to have America involved, you have to have Turkey involved. I think the important thing should be no external country should have a veto over which groups could attend a peace conference. For example, Turkey has vetoed Kurdish participation in peace conferences in the past, and that's a problem. You can't, you know, there's no solution without a solution to the Kurdish question. So you need everybody involved. In terms of what's going to be done with Assad, how you would have a transition of power, that would be something that people would have to work out in detail. But the first step, which we're not at the moment, would be bring all the players together. And, you know, trying to encourage at least a shift away from violence towards, you know, maybe a real ceasefire backed perhaps both by Russia and the United States. And, you know, whether that's realistic or not is another question. But, you know, have some kind of ceasefire and then some kind of negotiated political transition, maybe a freedom, you know, a peace you know, one of the great innovations of the decolonization of South Africa and the end of apartheid, one of the great innovations was the Peace and Reconciliation Commission. And I think that's something that's very needed in a place like Syria. People have done horrible things to one another for a long time. And, you know, at the end of the day, when you have such a type of civil war, you know, arresting everybody, you know, is not going to solve the problem. But I think it would be very healthy for a society like Syria to talk about the traumas that it's been through. So, you know, I don't want to put my finger on any kind of particular solution because I'm not a Syrian. And, you know, like it ultimately should be up to Syrians to decide their own fate. But, you know, my general perspective would be, you know, upping the ante with military intervention is not going to be very helpful. And more generally, you know, like the crocodile tears of the muscular liberals don't really over poison gas do not really sway me, especially, you know, when these guys are not providing the aid or allowing Syrian refugees into the United States. Those on the left who are like so critical of Kurdish groups for accepting support from the United States need to kind of like understand that, you know, it's pretty easy to sit in your like, you know, anarchist commune in like Seattle or Vancouver or, you know, like, you know, it's particularly a Canadian thing I noticed.
Portland. I'm in Portland.
You're in Portland, you know, it's easy to be critical for Kurds taking support from the United States, especially, you know, like in the context of the Syrian civil war. But, you know, there's a basic reality. When you have a group like ISIS coming for you and you're surrounded by hostile forces, whether it's Turkey, the Assad regime, and so on and so forth, you know, it's all great to talk a big anti-imperialist game, but, you know, do you really want to sacrifice yourself? You know, those people who want the Kurds to sacrifice themselves for some abstract anti-imperialism really need to sort of check that privilege to use that word. You know, like, it's difficult, you know. Kurds in Syria are under no illusions about American support. You know, the Kurds were an ally of last resort. The Obama administration didn't want to help the Kurdish groups. They only came into Syria to help Kurdish groups after ISIS was attacking Kobani, which would have been a PR disaster for the anti-ISIS coalition, and B, the PYD were the only group that seemed to be willing to fight against ISIS. So, you know, I would just ask people on the left, before rushing to judgment on this Kurdish alliance, to really consider, you know, try and demonstrate a little bit of empathy to people on the ground.
Great. Well, yeah, I agree with you completely, and
does that make sense?
Yeah, totally does. And I thought that was a really good conversation. You didn't.
Hello?
Sorry, I had muted myself and then forgot. So I was talking, but you didn't hear me. That was great. I agree with you completely. And it makes perfect sense. And I feel like this conversation was really good in so much as that it didn't simplify anything. You know, it only kind of scratched the surface, but showed how complex and difficult the situation is, and taking positions based on moral posturing or based on sort of sectarian ideological commitments just isn't going to fly. So I appreciate the conversation quite a lot.
Well, I hope it was helpful to you. I mean, like, I'm glad we got somewhere. Yeah, because I'm just very unhappy in general with the, you know, with the level of discourse on the left. You know, not everybody on the left. I mean, like,
Did you think this went well? I mean, did I do a good job?
Thank you so much for giving me a platform to talk about this thing, because I get very frustrated with this kind of binary that people put forward about the Syrian civil war. You know, it's complicated. It's, you know, and, you know, like you say, it's so easy to do moral posturing from your apartment in Toronto, right? Mm-hmm. And it's a kind of like, There's Tankies in particular and Stalinists, I think they suffer from a kind of sociopathy that American conservatives suffer from as well, you know, where it's just a skins and shirts game, isn't it? You know what I mean? It's
ridiculous. Yeah, right.
It's ridiculous. But, you know, it's, the Middle East is freaking complicated. And then guess what? There are no good bad guys. There are no good guys, right?
Yeah, and there are no bad guys exactly. Well, there are, but, you know, it's not that simple. It's just not a villains versus heroes situation.
Exactly. I mean, like, ISIS are villains, but also they're kind of sad. You know, they're just a bunch of young kids hopped up on methamphetamine who, like, are told that it's God's will to rape and kill.